This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Ali Abunima, the editor of the Electronic Intifada and the author of the recently published book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine.
It's an extraordinary interview about the Israeli assault on Gaza and the resistance to it, not only within Gaza, but within many of the populations in the world.
We'll also speak with Columbia law professor Catherine Franke on her efforts to get Professor Stephen Salata, the professor who was dehired at the University of Illinois, back into his job.
The letter she and many, many other academics signed is extraordinary, pointing out the history of University of Illinois banning controversial speech and the threat it is to the First Amendment and to free speech in this country.
We'll also speak with historian Professor Clarence Taylor, an expert on the history of police brutality, about what's going on in Ferguson, Missouri.
He points out that, yes, it's militarization of the police, but it's much more. It's racism, economic inequality, of police departments, and a government that's all white.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. We're excited to have with us today Ali Abunima, the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada, a newsletter blog that talks about the Middle East, and the author of an important book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. Ali Abunima will talk to us today about what's going on in Gaza, what are Israel's intentions, the resistance we're seeing around the world as well as on campuses throughout the United States, and also about the attempt to censor him when he wanted to give a talk about his book at the Evanston Public Library, an attempt that failed.
Ali Abunima, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
You wrote this really fine book, just published, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. And we see that battle unfolding in a very acute way right now with the breakdown of the ceasefire and the resumption of the bombing of Gaza. And I wanted to ask you, why did that ceasefire break down? What are the Israelis trying to do?
Well, it's very simple. The terms that Palestinians have put forward for a long-term ceasefire with Gaza, very straightforward, which is to end the siege, to end the collective punishment that has been grinding the people in Gaza, 1.8 million people there now, for 8 years. It has made life impossible. And the situation has gotten considerably worse over the past year because of the coup in Egypt. The coup regime in Egypt is very closely allied with Israel. And they've made it just impossible for 1.8 million people to live in Gaza. So this is what is at the root of what we're seeing right now. From the demand from across Palestinian civil society in Gaza, and again, it's important to stress that this is not a Hamas demand. This is a demand across Palestinian civil society. It's lift the siege, open the crossings, allow farmers to farm, allow fishermen to fish, allow factories to function, allow travelers to travel, students to go to their universities, patients to reach their hospitals without long delays and so on, allow medicines to come in, allow books to come in. You mentioned my book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. Well, there's no way to get that book or any other book into Gaza. That's what siege means. It's not just a siege on physical goods, but it's also a siege on human contact and culture and education and nourishment. So this is what Palestinians are saying, end the siege. Israel thought that through bombing Gaza, through this massacre in which they've now killed more than one out of every 1,000 people in Gaza in the past month or so.
What was that figure you just gave again, Ali? Can you say that again?
They have killed now more than 2,000 people in Gaza, which is one out of every 1,000 residents of Gaza has been killed. So to put this in perspective, your chances of winning the lottery are roughly 1 in 175 million. your chances of being killed by Israel in Gaza over the last month or so is 1 in 1,000. You know, if you had a 1 in 1,000 chance of winning the lottery, you'd be probably spending a lot of money on lottery tickets. Just to give you a sense that of how pervasive death is in Gaza, and entire families are being wiped out, entire families have been wiped out, nobody feels safe. This massacre, Israel thought, this pogrom, Israel thought, would break people's will and get them to accept to go back under siege. And what people are saying in Gaza is that, you know, we've tried siege, we've tried slow death, with the world just, you know, patting Israel on the back, and we're no longer willing to take it. So nobody in Gaza wants to be bombed. Nobody in Gaza wants to die or have family members die. But people are pretty firm that the siege is a slow death. It's what Ilan Papir, the Israeli historian, has called a slow genocide. Israel has to lift the siege. But Israel won't, because it's a matter of pride for them. It's a matter of colonial control. If they lift the siege now, after losing dozens of soldiers trying to invade Gaza, after causing so much destruction, it will look like a defeat for Israel. And Israel's just not prepared to accept that.
Well, if they won't lift the siege, and they won't allow for a Palestinian nation, and if they won't allow for Palestinians to have equal rights with Israelis, where are they going?
Well, the most frightening statement of where they're going was made more than 10 years ago. I wrote about this recently in an article called "The Gaza Massacre is the Price of a Jewish State," which people can, you know, they could just Google that and find it. But the statement that I quote from a senior advisor to Ariel Sharon, who was the prime minister at the time of Israel's so-called Gaza disengagement, you know, at this time you had the so-called international community engaging in these fantasies about Gaza becoming, you know, a new Singapore on the Mediterranean. Well, the Israelis were saying to themselves that actually Gaza is going to be a giant holding pen for surplus human beings who are not Jewish, basically. I mean, the reason Palestinians are caged up in Gaza is because they're a demographic threat to the Jewish state. And what this advisor, Arnon Sofer, said, and I quote him, basically is that, you know, we're just going to have to keep bombing them. And the exact phrase he used is, we're going to have to kill and kill and kill all day, every day, in order to suppress them, in order to get the message to them that they have no future, and that eventually they will give up and they will leave. They will go to Egypt, they will go to Syria, they will go wherever. And that was 10 years ago, but you don't have to go back that far, because just in the past 2 weeks, Moshe Feiglin, the deputy speaker of the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, made an almost identical proposal. He said, let's concentrate the Palestinians in tent encampment by the Egyptian border and arrange for them to be taken to other countries. And then he said we would completely destroy, we would cut off the water and electricity to the formerly populated areas of Gaza, and then completely destroy and flatten them and exterminate anyone who remains behind. Those are his words. I mean, this is the thing. He's using the words like concentrate them in tent encampment. What does that sound like to you? He's the deputy speaker of what Barack Obama calls a vibrant democracy.
Well, Ali, you know, it's Michael, it's Ratner, it's, you know, it's horrible to hear you describe it like this. I mean, our view here is that what you're saying is really right as what's going on. But I'd like to ask you, what do you see in the foreseeable future, let's say the next couple of months on this? And how do you see the U.S. reaction has been awful? The populations of the world have been much better, at least in many of the demonstrations I've been in and others. But where do you see this going? And within Gaza, how are the people going to survive it?
You know, I can say this. If we are going to wait for governments to act or to do the right thing or for the UN to get its act together, then we're doomed and it's gloomy and we should give up. But I'm incredibly hopeful. exactly because of what you said, Michael, the mobilization around the world, that despite the multiple levels of complicity by this government in this country and governments in Europe and in the Arab world, something is happening. And it does add up to something. Yes, the marches are very important. But more than that, you know, the sustained, we're not starting from zero. We have a really important and sustained boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. We have to also support efforts of legal accountability. That's something I know that you've been involved in, and groups like the Center for Constitutional Rights and others have been involved in for years. That's never been more important, you know, to use the law, to bring some accountability. I mean, the weapons that are being used in Gaza, I did a piece yesterday on the Electronic Intifada about how indiscriminate, you know, this myth that Israel puts around that our weapons are precise and targeted. No, they are firing weapons that are effectively indiscriminate, artillery, mortar shells, that are designed to be indiscriminate into populated areas in Gaza with the intended consequence of causing widespread destruction. We have to go after the weapons manufacturers. We have to go after the people that approve these sales from around the world. And it's because of public pressure that the UK announced last week that they would suspend arms exports to Israel if, quote-unquote, significant hostilities resumed. Well, now they have resumed. Let's see what they do. But they would not even have gone that far without the public pressure. So I'm really hopeful for what's happening. Look at what's happening. Just this week, an Israeli cargo ship was prevented from unloading now for 4 days in Oakland because solidarity activists and unionized port workers have been working together to prevent that. We've seen activists being arrested in the office of Senator Dianne Feinstein. We've seen this happening in the UK. This adds up to something. And it's where I think we have to put our efforts. We can't just be waiting for something to happen. And the great news is people are not waiting anymore.
We're speaking with Ali Abu Nima, the author of the recently published book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. It truly is the best book on Palestine in a decade, and we recommend it to everybody. You conclude in your book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine, with this sentence: "The battle for justice in Palestine is now decisively shifting." And would you still say that, given what's happened in Gaza, or would you say it and underline it? How do you feel about the reaction around the world and in America to what the Israelis have done?
I have no doubt that it's shifting. And this, you know, this horror in Gaza, this pogrom, doesn't change the basic dynamics. It only underscores many of the points are made in the book, that Israel can only maintain its dominance over Palestinians through brute force, horrifying use of violence against Palestinians there, and through attempts to suppress debate, to suppress political action on behalf of Palestinian rights in the United States and around the world, but particularly in the United States. And in the book, I detail all the different ways the efforts of censorship, the efforts of Hasbara or propaganda operate. And I think we see these failing. I mean, Michael mentioned that in this country, you know, public support for Israel is very high, including during this massacre. And that's true. But there's really another story that I think is very, very important, that poll after poll has been showing since the Israeli massacre began, which is that young people are not buying it. Young people are overwhelmingly not buying it. African American, Latino American, they are very clearly taking the position that the Palestinians have been wronged here. You look at all the key demographics. The younger and the browner people are, the more they see the reality. Well, young people are the future of this country. And you look at the way voting patterns are going, you know, it's really older, whiter people where the solid support for Israel is. And that's a trend that is mirrored in, you know, many other political positions in this country. those, you know, wealthier, whiter baby boomers are, in a sense, the repository of much of the most reactionary politics in this country. And that's true with Palestine, and that explains much of the panic among, you know, major pro-Israel institutions about the loss of a grip on the narrative, the failure of various propaganda initiatives I talk about in the book. And in particular, this is true among the American Jewish community, where, you know, groups like AIPAC and the ADL and the American Jewish Committee really cannot claim to speak for a unified Jewish community that's behind Israel. You have groups like Jewish Voice for Peace that has played a very visible, incredibly important role over the past 2 years in helping things like, you know, helping Palestinians and Presbyterians to win the vote for divestment just a few months ago. These are really very significant shifts that are happening.
I agree with you, Ali. Particularly, I mean, look, at JVP has just bloomed in terms of membership in the last
50,000
few months. I mean, just going up dramatically, which I think is really important. I imagine that Electronic Intifada, your blog newsletter, has increased readership that's probably double, triple, quadruple.
Well, actually, since the attack on Gaza began, we have had more readers in just, you know, a month and a half, or less than a month and a half, than in the whole of 2013. What that tells you is that there is an incredible thirst for news, for analysis. You know, I was talking with a colleague yesterday. I mean, we have this kind of story we tell ourselves about progress, that, you know, if we are smart, if we're active, if we educate journalists, then mainstream media is going to open up to alternative voices. Well, actually what's happened is that mainstream media in this country is more closed to Palestinian voices than at any time I've seen in 20 years. You know, a decade ago during the Second Intifada, I used to get on CNN. I used to get on MSNBC. That doesn't happen anymore. You know, the New York Times used to have better coverage 10 years ago than they do today under Jody Rodoran's Jerusalem Bureau. But so, you know, in a sense, there's been a circling of the wagon to shut out voices. But the good news about this is that it doesn't matter the way it used to. The gatekeepers don't have the same power through social media, through independent media, through groups like JVP, through Students for Justice in Palestine. We're actually changing the politics and changing the narrative. And I don't think they're going to be able to stop it. That's why I argue in the book the battle is decisively shifting. But they're sure as heck going to try. And so we're going to see a doubling down of censorship efforts, of bullying, of efforts to silence politicians. And that's why, in a sense, you know, we see we're kind of at the peak of that, which is why the United States Senate voted 100-0 to support the Israeli attack on Gaza.
When you saw that vote, it was so shocking. It was similar in the House of Representatives, as I recall. No dissent. No,
there were six in the House.
In the House?
Yeah.
On that issue or on the Iron Dome, Michael?
Whatever it was.
I think it was Iron Dome. There were six, yeah. But then someone like Barbara Lee voted in favor of Iron Dome, yeah, saying it's for defensive purposes. So I wrote her saying, well, how about giving that to the Palestinians in Gaza? They need it a lot more than Israel. Of course, she didn't get back to me. But I want to go, now that you're talking about a lot of things and the popularity now of the website, as well as I think your book is probably flying off the shelves, but a significant battle you yourself won, your book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine, which I hope is flying out of wherever it can be gotten, which is, I assume, everywhere. You recently had an attempt to get you not to speak in Evanston, Illinois. Can you just tell us what happened with that, Ali?
Yeah, what happened was that I'd been invited back in June to speak at the Evanston Public Library as an author event. It was a standalone event. You know, they have authors come through all the time, and I agreed to that. And that was fine. The library advertised it. They sent out press releases, etc. And then just about a week before, the librarian who had organized the event let me know that the director of the library had basically ordered the event to be canceled. until they could get a pro-Israel speaker. And there was such an uproar. I mean, it was amazing. They did a U-turn pretty quickly, and they, you know, tried to deny that this had been, I think what it clearly was, an act of really outright politically motivated censorship. I mean, it's good. I give them credit for making that U-turn very quickly. I give them credit for the event as it went on. You know, they certainly did put on an event which was far better attended than it would have been otherwise. I mean, the library was overflowing, and there were a couple of overflow sites with you know, dozens more people watching on video. And so it gave me an opportunity to talk particularly about Gaza, but about Palestine in general, in a space that would have been closed if there hadn't been this uproar. And, you know, people writing in from all over the country, including many librarians. And it was really nice to get notes from librarians saying, you know, you can come and speak at our library. A very strong free speech movement.
I love
it. That was so important. But, you know, at the end, the stakes for me were very low. I mean, it was a battle that I was, of course, going to fight because very, very important principles of that. But, you know, my life would not have changed dramatically if I did or didn't speak at the Evanston Public Library. But where we see these battles really at a much higher stakes game is what's going on now with my friend and electronic intifada writer, Stephen Salaita, who was fired from a tenured position he was just hired to at the University of Illinois, pretty much because of his statements opposing the massacre in Gaza. This is, in a sense, we have to go back to the times of McCarthyism and earlier to find this kind of attack on academic freedom in the United States. And so far, more than 2,400 scholars around the United States have pledged publicly not to engage with the University of Illinois until they reverse this decision. But we're going to see more and more of this because as Israel and its apologists and lobbies lose control of the narrative, lose control of the politics in this country, there is a more and more blatant resort to outright repression, such as what is going on now at the University of Illinois and other institutions around the country.
You anticipated my question because you have a very fine chapter in your book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine, on just that. It's called The War on Campus. And you give a lot of examples of this kind of repression that really goes back to the apartheid regime in South Africa, or even the fascist regime in Germany, or the dictators in South America. They can't stand academic freedom. This is what's happening with the blowback from the United States supporting Israel and the various forces in the United States working with the Israeli government, trying to repress people like you and people like Professor Salaita when they try to voice their opinions on campuses. So the chapter, The War on Campus, is worth the book alone, Ali. I thought it was really terrific.
Thank you so much. Well, you know, the interesting thing, in that chapter, I cite an organization called the David Project, which is a Zionist group that's been working for more than 10 years, attacking and targeting professors. For example, Joseph Massad of Columbia University, who's been the target of a years-long campaign by the David Project and others. But they make a very important observation in a white paper that they published in 2012, saying that basically the future of the U.S.-Israel relationship and the future of U.S. support for Israel, meaning, of course, unconditional U.S. support for Israeli apartheid and colonization and massacres, is going to be decided on campus. That if the pro-Israel groups lose the campuses, then basically it's just a matter of time before they've lost America. That's the David Project's own analysis, and it's one I happen to agree with. And we're already seeing, again, reflecting in some of these polls I mentioned, this shift among young people in this country. But that helps explain why so much resource and so much effort is being put now into trying to suppress teaching, discussion, and activism about Palestine and Israel on U.S. campuses. And it involves everything from targeting individuals, as we've mentioned, to these sort of pseudo-legal strategies like filing bogus civil rights complaints against universities, claiming that administrators are fostering a hostile environment for Jewish students because they're failing to crack down on, you know, activism by Students for Justice in Palestine and other groups. So a real perverse use of important civil rights legislation in this country that's designed to guarantee students' rights and perverting it to use it to actually suppress free speech and suppress activism and teaching on campus. No. So that battle is really raging. Stephen Salaita case shows us that it's going to intensify, if anything.
This is Michael Ratner. Really glad you made that point. I mean, I remember 3 years ago, or four, we began what's called the Palestine Solidarity Legal Support Project, and you know the people running it. It was primarily set up because of what was happening on college campuses, looking at that as the center of where we would hope to see activism on behalf of Palestinian rights, and of course where we've seen a huge, huge reaction. So I thank you, and this interview was such an incredible honor to be able to listen to you talk about it, Ollie. And I want to encourage people to go to the Electronic Intifada, which is the news. How do you describe it, as a newsletter or a blog? How do you describe it, Ollie?
Full spectrum publication. We have original reporting, analysis. We have blogs. I'm really proud of the work that all my colleagues are doing, especially those who have been reporting from Gaza.
Get information from the Electronic Intifada, and definitely get Ollie Abu Nima's book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. It'll be a real wake-up call for people who don't know a lot about what's going on. Thank you, Ollie.
Thank you, Ollie.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thanks.
Today, we're going to talk about the dehiring of Professor Stephen Salaita, who is to teach in the American Indian Studies program at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He was dehired because of statements on social media criticizing Israel's conduct of military operations in Gaza. His dehiring has raised serious concerns about academic freedom and free speech in universities, not just in Illinois, but throughout the United States. Recently, scholars from law schools at Columbia, Cornell, Berkeley, Georgetown, and others have come out with a strong letter condemning the decision of the University of Illinois to dehire Stephen Salaita. Today, we'll talk with Professor Catherine Franke, Isidore and Seville Sulzberger Professor of Law and Director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality at Columbia University.
This interview was taped last week. Subsequently, there have been some important developments. The Board of Trustees of the University of Illinois has issued a statement backing up the actions of Chancellor Wise, who rescinded the job offer to Professor Salaita. Second important development are some disclosures that were recently revealed under records obtained under the Open Records Law. The organization, Inside Higher Ed, asked for records, and what they demonstrate, according to the website at Inside Higher Ed, is, and I quote, "The communications show that Wise was lobbied on the decision not only by pro-Israel students, parents, and alumni, but also by the fundraising arm of the university. The communications also show that the university system president was involved." Again, go to that website, InsideHigherEd.com, and read the emails yourself. And now we'll turn to Catherine Franke, professor at Columbia, who was the author of the important letter objecting to the firing or dismissal of Stephen Salaita.
Catherine Franke, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, it's my delight to be with you.
Catherine, we've been following the situation for Professor Stephen Salaita, and I know you've been active on that struggle. But can you give us a little bit of the background, who Stephen is, what happened to him, what university, and then some of what the work you did?
Professor Salaita was made a tenured offer of appointment at the University of Illinois in their American Studies program, American Indian Studies program, last year, and he accepted it. You know, negotiated the terms of the offer, and then when during the most recent assault on Gaza, he was active on Twitter, as he often is, expressing his views on various things having to do with the Middle East and colonialism. And the university came under an enormous amount of pressure, the University of Illinois did, to revoke the offer of employment to Professor Salaita. And as it turns out, the offer had not been absolutely finalized yet. There's usually a rubber stamp process where the department and the head of the university have to take the appointment to the Board of Trustees. And so the chancellor of the university, Phyllis Wise, informed Professor Salaita that she would not be bringing his appointment to the Board of Trustees and was unwilling to finalize his appointment. Now, he had already resigned in a position at Virginia Tech and was getting ready to move. He's a well-known scholar, not only of American Indian studies, but of colonialism more generally, and has connected up the struggle for sovereignty and an analysis of genocide and occupation in the United States to the struggles that Palestinians have suffered in the Middle East. It's not that his views on Israel and Palestine were unknown to the university and to his department. When he applied for this position, had his work reviewed, they solicited outside letters, and they decided to make him an offer. So what he said in his tweets, while impassioned, as Twitter usually is, certainly didn't depart from political views he'd expressed before. But I think they, in the heat of the moment of this most recent assault on Gaza, the university basically buckled and withdrew the offer, and he's now without a job and an income. It's because of his speech on the issue of war crimes that may have been committed by Israel in the assault on Gaza.
Who do you think was responsible for putting that kind of pressure on the university? I've read in one place that the Simon Wiesenthal Foundation out of L.A. was one, but have you any information on what forces were involved in getting him unhired?
I don't know specifically. The university certainly hasn't divulged anything, and nor has any organization taken credit for this victory from their side. I wouldn't be surprised if it was members of the Wiesenthal Center, but there are ample advocates for Zionist positions who would have been troubled by the things that Professor Salaita said on Twitter. He's also had a history of saying things that were designed to point out instances of anti-Semitism. His tweets have been rather even, I think, across the board in terms of criticizing the critics of Israel when they've overstepped, but also criticizing Israel itself. So he's a fiery guy with strong opinions and rigorous academic critiques of colonialism and colonial violence. So the criticisms could have come from a number of different sources, but it would surprise me for it to have been some of the more well-established pro-Israeli organizations.
We're speaking with Professor Catherine Franke about the dehiring of Professor Stephen Salaita at the University of Illinois. We'll be back to you right after the break.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Professor Catherine Franke about the dehiring of Professor Stephen Salaita at the University of Illinois.
been a very strong response, I think, by a community of wide variety of academics as well as others to the firing, in part, I hesitate to use the word because I don't know how you feel about it, led by you, though, Catherine Franke, and you're the first signatory on a very powerful letter to the chancellor, Phyllis Wise, at the university. Can you tell us how that came about and what some of your main arguments are and how that letter has been received, at least by the academics, if not by the university?
Well, there was a pretty immediate response across the spectrum of academics, from English departments to historians to anthropologists, largely saying that they would boycott the University of Illinois, and this is their campus at Urbana-Champaign, until such time as Professor Salida's position was reinstated and they took the appointment to the Board of Trustees. Many of those statements were quite critical and offered an analysis of what was wrong with Professor Wise, or excuse me, Dr. Wise's position. And I felt it would be useful to add constitutional and legal analysis of the problem and situate it historically in threats to free speech on campus. And so I drafted a letter for constitutional law professors to sign, not in which they would agree to boycott the university, because I felt I would have a smaller group of law professors willing to sign up for that, but more offering a constitutional analysis of retaliation against unpopular speech. And so we walk through in the letter both the constitutional doctrine, but also the fact that so much of the Supreme Court's free speech jurisprudence decisions have been about the rights of academics to speak out in on matters of public concern, often in unpopular ways. Really, the law in this area has been made by faculty and sometimes students. And so it's important to situate this particular incident in that longer arc of the jurisprudence. But then I brought it back to the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and pointed out their own history of threats to free speech, both during the McCarthy period when bills were introduced in Springfield to punish or purge people who might have had what they called back then communist sympathies from working in public universities. And then in 1960, there was a biologist, a professor in the biology department at Urbana-Champaign, that had written and spoke about human sexuality and it actually had endorsed premarital sex, among other things.
Something, it's a very powerful part of the letter. I mean,
yeah,
I'm sure
your listeners are very upset right now to hear about it. Anyway, he was disciplined by the university. He was terminated. And the American Association of University Professors actually sanctioned the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana for this action. So what I found quite ironic is that the university has a website as part of their library that documents this history of assaults on academic freedom at the Champaign-Urbana campus. And this incident is unfortunately just the next iteration of what have been really unfortunate problems around respecting the rights of faculty.
Wait, you're saying they have a website just
that
on
that?
That
has all of the documents uploaded that states the histories of the issues going back to the mid-40s around early McCarthy kinds of stuff, and then this Professor Koch, who was the advocate of premarital sex, that incident is documented there. And so one of the things I point out in the letter is that, unfortunately, the archivists that are employed by Dr. Wise are going to have to include this event in their own online archive of threats to academic freedom on campus.
Catherine, you're a law professor at Columbia. So let me take advantage of your expertise on behalf of our listeners and ask you if you could give us in a nutshell the First Amendment law and the law on academic freedom so that our listeners can understand just how shocking and grotesque what Chancellor Wise did here.
Well, there are a couple of principles that are at stake here. One has to do with the state punishing any citizen for speaking on an unpopular topic, and particularly punishing them for the viewpoint they take. So, for instance, there's another faculty member at the University of Illinois, Carrie Nelson, who has been a rather enthusiastic advocate of Israel's right to attack Gaza. He said things that are quite inflammatory. He has not been fired. He has not been punished for the positions he's taken on the Middle East. What instead that the university has done is punished those who are critics of Israel. And the Constitution's First Amendment Free Speech Clause prohibits a state university or any other state entity from punishing or assigning some kind of penalty to a citizen who speaks and voices a viewpoint that's unpopular with whoever those public officials might be. And that's clearly what happened in this case. So that's one principle that's at stake here, is what we call viewpoint discrimination. The second principle is that of academic freedom. Universities are really the primary bastion of a domain where we protect the pursuit of unpopular ideas, of controversial ideas, of ideas that might even be frightening. That is the commitment that we make as part of the academic endeavor, is to unsettle what are our comfortable ideas about a range of truths, from whether the world is flat or to whether war crimes have been committed in the Middle East on either side of this conflict. And the point of that concept of academic freedom is that we don't want to have a kind of orthodoxy or an official version of the truth, particularly in an academic setting where we can pursue alternative theories that might end up later to reveal themselves to be more true than the ones which were dominant or orthodox before. And clearly punishing Professor Salaita for his unpopular positions here will have a chilling effect on future applicants for employment at that university, other faculty at that university, students at that university, and the Supreme Court's jurisprudence has been very clear that actions by a state official like Dr. Wise that have the effect of chilling speech are unconstitutional.
I thought that was a really strong point of your letter, Catherine. I mean, when you talk about if you're a professor who's about to apply for a job at that university, or you're, you know, any kind of person seeking work, how are you going to speak out? Your tweets are going to be followed. They're never going to hire you.
Well, I'm pretty confident I would not be able to get a job there now, that Dr. Wise would not take my candidacy to the Board of Trustees.
Right, and you're a full professor at Columbia Law School.
Yeah, so, I'm a chaired professor.
Chaired professor,
Columbia.
So what can we say? Let me ask you this. I think there was a very strong positive reaction to the letter. How many signatories do you have on the letter?
You know, it's changing every day. We keep getting people coming in. I just actually, before I got on the line with you here, sent the letter to several members of the Board of Trustees that now has about 30 signatories, ranging from Harvard Law School to Columbia Law School to Rutgers to UCLA, Hastings, you know, Whittier, all range of law schools and faculty who are begging, really, to be put on this letter. They're so outraged by what the University of Illinois has done.
And has there been any reaction from the university?
None.
Really?
None.
Wow.
I know that the Board of Trustees met, the Executive Committee did, on Monday, and they discussed the case, but they say they have not reached a decision about it, and they are not scheduled to meet again until sometime into mid-September. But the overwhelming pressure that they are feeling from the academic community, never mind a broader community, has to compel them to take this up in some way. Because, you know, I was invited, oddly enough, this summer I was invited by several members of the faculty at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, to come speak there in September on several issues having to do with critical approaches to law. And I was delighted to go. I grew up in Chicago. I thought this would be great to go back. And then this event occurred, and I also signed a letter that said I would boycott any speaking engagement at the university until this matter was resolved favorably for Professor Salaita. Some other professors are going further, and they're saying not only will we not go to your campus and speak, we also won't cooperate in requests for letters for tenure and promotion. Now, this basically shuts down the central academic project at the University of Illinois if they're being shunned by the academic community across the country. Now, I find the tactic both appealing and troubling in a couple of ways. It's appealing because of the pressure it will put on the university. It's troubling because it shifts the cost of what the university institutionally has done to its junior faculty, who shouldn't be held accountable for this. So I know that those who were urging a boycott even of writing letters and helping in tenure and promotion cases have worked closely with the faculty at the University of Illinois to get their buy-in to this tactic. But it is a pretty extreme thing to do, and that's a signal of how strongly people feel about this issue.
You know, I have a friend who is also a chaired professor there in the history department, and he was most pessimistic. Of course, this was a week ago before your letter started getting the great support that it's been getting. But my friend said, you know, I don't think that Chancellor Wise, knowing what I know about her, is going to do a thing, and that unless there's a lot of action on Stephen Salata's behalf by the students and by the faculty and public rallies, leaflets, and so on, I don't think she's going to be moved at all. So I was very happy to hear what you said about your letter getting that kind of great support. You know, I think it's worthwhile pointing out that if Professor Salata brings a lawsuit, he may well win it. There's a legal principle here called estoppel. If you act to your detriment based on a promise, and this poor guy gave up a tenured job, gave up his house, and was ready to move with his wife and his child to Illinois, and then they sawed off the branch he was standing on. If you rely on that kind of promise to your detriment, you've got a pretty strong legal argument. And I think you could say that going to the Board of Trustees after he had received a signed offer is really a technicality. So I think he may, not only on the basis of free speech fight, but just on the basis of straight contract law, he might be able to win here. What do you think?
I think that's right. And we do make an estoppel argument in the letter, although part of what I see happening in this case that also relates to the estoppel question is the increasing corporatization of the academy and of the leadership of universities. And Professor Dr. Wise comes out of a somewhat corporate background. She, I think, in some ways is the poster woman, if you will, for the sort of executive that is now leading universities and thinks of the university as a business more than as a special kind of enterprise that is committed to a set of values that are irrelevant in a corporate context but are essential in the context of learning and the pursuit of research and the preservation of academic freedom. I've seen this in other presidents of universities, even closer to home here in New York, when they've run into problems with the speech of their students or their faculty around Israel and Palestine because their donors, who are largely supportive of Israel, put enormous pressure on the heads of these universities. And the presidents are making an economic calculation that they can pay off someone like Salaita and satisfy their donors that they've purged the university of somebody with these kinds of perspectives, rather than seeing the importance of the underlying academic value at stake in this case.
Catherine, are there any next steps planned by you or others on this case? Or,
Well, there are. Every day there's another academic organization signing a letter of opposition to this event. But I have to say to both of you that as much as I have endorsed the academic and cultural boycott of Israel, and I signed a letter saying I was boycotting the University of Illinois until this case was resolved, we can't just agree to do nothing, which is what a boycott is. In a way, it's the easiest thing to do, to say that I won't go. If for those who have agreed to sign boycotts around these issues, think about what you will do in addition to what you're not going to do. And so I'm still going to go to Urbana-Champaign, but I'm not going to speak on campus. I'm not going to take university money. And I'm going to hold a teach-in right off campus about academic freedom and about the issues that are at stake here. Because I feel ignoring and abandoning that community when there are a lot of faculty and students who are also troubled by this decision on the part of the university does a disservice to those activists on campus. And it refusing to participate, in a way, is not an act of cowardice, but it is the easiest thing to do. So I would urge all of your listeners who are troubled about this to do more, if they feel so moved, than signing the boycott. But also think about what affirmatively you can do to move the needle on this issue.
I thought that was a really creative thing when you said it there, and you had referred to it in a note to me, and I said I want to explore this more, and then I saw that you were going to do this off-campus thing, which I think is just brilliant.
And I'm going to put you in touch with my contacts there to get you some help on that. How would people who listen to this show get your letter so they can read it?
Corey Robin, I know, has it on his website.
Parts of the letter are all over the place. The whole letter you can get if you do a little bit.
The whole
bit.
Letter is a link
right
on the Mondo Weiss site.
Good.
I have it as a and it's saved as a public PDF file on Dropbox. And I can send you the link for it if you want to put it on your website.
That would be great.
We will definitely do that.
Okay. I have a last question for you, Catherine, because it's sort of the way Ali Abu Nima ended his interview, saying that as we've gotten into the Gaza war and the street demonstrations and everything else against the war that are going on both in this country and around the world, he notices, he believes that there's a crackdown that's heavier and a circling of the wagons, as he would put it, at universities and perhaps in other places as well, as they want to stop that kind of dissent happening, certainly within academia. I don't know if we have enough experience at this point with that, with your experience yet. What
well,
do you
again,
think about
I think
that?
This is a problem of the corporatization of the university, is that they don't want to scare their donors with the things that are going on campus. But I would say that I have a lot of faith in students. I was just down in Maryland a couple weeks ago talking to J Street U students, and I have some pretty strong disagreements with many of the positions that J Street has taken, but they have this university-based project where they're training student activists who are members of J Street to do work on campus that marry an idea of a state of Israel to Palestinian rights and to human rights, and the students are way out ahead of where the leadership of J Street is. And I think that there are moments to intervene on campus with the Students for Justice in Palestine students. The Jewish Voice for Peace is creating campus-based organizations to talk about these issues. J Street U is. And I think they're tired of this old rhetoric. So I actually think things are going to – a lot of interesting stuff is going to happen when students return to campus in the next few weeks. It's part of what I'm working on, is to create a context for that to be a productive conversation, not just name-calling.
Well, that's great. Well, Catherine Franke, again, thank you for all your work. The letter is fantastic. I recommend it to everybody. And hopefully we'll have a job reinstated soon.
Yeah, I hope so, too. Thank you both for inviting me to talk to you.
Thank you for being on.
All righty. Take care.
So long.
In the days since the police shooting and killing of unarmed teenager Michael Brown, state and local law enforcement have been cycling through different approaches to the demonstrators in Ferguson, Missouri. They rolled out armored vehicles, police in riot gear. They deployed tear gas, stun grenades, and shotguns. Another decision permitted the state highway patrol to march with the protesters. Then the National Guard was ordered in. Multiple personnel in military uniforms and riot gear have suppressed the protesters. We examine the history and consequences of police repression and militarized law enforcement with Baruch College civil rights professor Clarence Taylor. He's the author of many books, including co-editor of Civil Rights Since 1787, A Reader in the Black Struggle. He's currently writing a history of police brutality in New York City from the 1930s to the 1960s.
Professor Clarence Taylor, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
The events in Ferguson, Missouri over the last couple of weeks have really revealed a militarization of police and also exposed to many people who didn't know the number of African-American men who are killed by police officers every day in this country. Given the historic context for this, why do you think this particular event has received such a response, evoked emotions among the general public?
Well, I think the response from the public is something that we have seen before. You know, one can go back and look in the 1930s and see people pouring out in large numbers through protests, police brutality. This is nothing new. I mean, police brutality has been around for a very long time. It's been an important civil rights issue. And this is something I have argued in my writings, that, you know, we can't talk about a post-civil rights era. You know, we have these issues are still with us today. The media, of course, pays attention every time there's a big explosion. But it's the people on the ground who are essentially who are fed up, who have gone through this. And I think what is reflected here in the Michael Brown killing is the fact that people have experienced this police brutality over and over again. I think, you know, the media sort of like it's paying attention to this issue. But like I said, you know, this is deep rooted. I heard the mayor of Ferguson saying that there is no racial divide in Ferguson. I don't know what planet he's on, but it's clear there's a racial divide in that city, expressed over and over by black residents. Can look at the just the number of traffic stops, well, thousands of them, you know, and a few hundred of them are white drivers, thousands of black drivers who are stopped and searched and, of course, are arrested. Hundreds are arrested. There's a few blacks that are in the police force. Yeah, and that's an issue, by the way, that has been pushed over and over again by people on the ground. It's not just arguing for a black face in a high place, you know, having police from the community, I think, is significant. There is no requirement in Ferguson for police to live in that community. The fact that having black officers also will change the nature of the investigation, I think, is very important. And like I said, this is something that's been argued going back and looking in the 1930s and 1940s when people were organizing against police brutality.
Now, we're taping this show as Eric Holder is actually visiting Ferguson. But what is your take on the symbolism of his going there?
It's important that the Attorney General of the United States goes. The people of Ferguson, and frankly, people throughout this country, have expressed their concern about the local prosecutor, a person who is well-connected with the police department, a person who criticized the governor for allowing the highway patrol to come out after the local police proved themselves unwilling to take any serious action against this police officer. It's going to take more than just the federal government involvement in this case. This issue in Ferguson, I mean, we see it playing out throughout the country. I mean, there's just countless numbers of police brutality cases that we'll never hear about. It raises the question about policing in these communities. I know there's been a lot of emphasis on the militarization of the police, but we should not take our eyes off of the racial component of this. And police brutality would still go on without the militarization of the police. I think the militarization of the police has made it much more difficult, of course, because it's created a certain mindset. We throw all these new toys at the police department, and, you know, once you give them a big enough hammer, everything looks like a nail. So I think we clearly have to address that, but what we have to address is how police departments operate in communities. Well, I think we're going to, if we don't address that problem, we're going to see more of these clashes.
Professor Taylor, it's been a pleasure to have your insights on these pressing issues, and we hope to talk with you when your forthcoming book is out.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Sure. If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.